Thanks to donors like you, Aquinas 101 is setting the world aflame with the truth, but the next season can't be filmed without your help. Dozens of new episodes are planned, but they'll only be brought to life if you make them possible. Your gift by October 31st will bring the truth to students, families, and people around the world. Please use the link in the episode description below to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Let's suppose that you're sitting at your desk writing sentences in your notebook using a pen. There's no desks here, unfortunately, but you could imagine doing this. Your action of writing words includes forming their components, the letters. Sometimes your pen strokes will neatly form the words that you are writing, but other times they'll just be off. Your pen stroke might go too far below the line, producing tails on your Fs that unduly interfere with the words on the next line. Or they might go too high, producing ungainly lowercase letters that stick above the midpoint of the line. Other times, you will hastily dot your I's so that the dots are placed above adjacent letters, or cross your T's such that the crossbars fail to intersect with their stems. Alas, this description is a fair characterization of how far my own script handwriting has degenerated since Mrs. Crivello taught me in the second grade. I do have one consolation, which is that I'm more and more being conformed to my patron Thomas Aquinas in his own illegible handwriting. My fine motor skills, which in my case are neither fine nor skilled, or rather human fine motor skills, are not directed determinately toward constraining letters within the boundaries of ruled lines, placing crossbars on stems, and dots upon I's. Rather, they can either achieve such endpoints or not, depending on whether we actually direct them that way. As we know, we require training to be reliably determined to the goals of crafts. In the case of penmanship, we need a teacher's instruction and much repetition of the component activities of the skill done well. Practice makes perfect. We might wonder what penmanship has to do with the naturalness of virtues. In fact, craft knowledge makes a good analogy with the virtues. If we are asked, are the virtues natural? We would have to say yes and no, but in different ways. To avoid keeping you in suspense, the answer is as follows. If by natural we mean that the virtues are inborn in us, and that we come pre-equipped with the virtues, as we do with, for instance, the power of touch, or that they develop automatically in us, then no, the virtues are not natural. Nor can we say that the virtues are natural if we are consulting the definition of nature given in Aristotle's Physics, Book 3, where he defines nature as the primary source of change in a thing. For virtues are not primary sources, but secondary sources of change. But if we attend to what virtues are, we will notice that they are very much like the craft of penmanship that we discussed above. For just as we humans are not reliably determined to placing dots on I's or crossbars on T's, we are also not reliably and automatically determined to desiring the right amount of food or returning the proper payment in exchanges, and so on. And just as in the case of skill, we can, by a kind of instruction and practice, acquire stable dispositions that determine us toward these outcomes. Now, in the Aristotelian tradition, the function of the human, who is defined as a rational animal, consists either in reasoning or in the putting of reason into our activities. These stable dispositions, the virtues, do precisely that. They reliably determine us toward putting reason's due order into our actions and desires. Consequently, the virtues are natural in this sense. They determine us reliably toward achieving that at which our nature is aimed. I'd like to spend my time in this lecture discussing this position at greater length. In order to do so, I will proceed in the following way. First, I'll exposit a text from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, Book 2, Chapter 1, where Aristotle raises the question of the naturalness of the virtues. In that text, Aristotle contrasts the activity of merely natural agents, like stones and fire, to voluntary agents, like humans, and thus sets the contrast between agents that are determined to one outcome and agents whose powers are indeterminate to several outcomes. Second, I will discuss the very notion of a virtue as what makes a thing and its activity good. We will see that goodness is ascribed to a thing on the basis of its function, and that a virtue is a quality that makes it do that function well. Third, I will discuss the notion of a power as a principle of action. We will see that there are many kinds of powers through which we act, but we will also see that there are some kinds of powers that have a kind of indeterminateness built into themselves, and which are thus fit to be habituated. Fourth, we will consider the virtue as a stable disposition that determines powers to a specific effect, concerning which it would not otherwise be determinately directed, namely, to putting the due order of reason into our action, and thus in directing us toward our flourishing. So the first part, Aristotle on the naturalness of virtue in Nicomachean Ethics, Book 2, Chapter 1. Aristotle notes at the outset of Nicomachean Ethics, Book 2, Chapter 1, that none of the virtues of character comes about in us naturally, since nothing natural can be habituated to be otherwise. Indeed, he uses a helpful example to illustrate this point, which I'll expand somewhat for dramatic purposes before we read the text. Imagine a boy with a pet rock. We'll call the rock Pete. Hitherto, Pete has not been a very promising pet. He has, however, some positive characteristics. Pete is very good at staying put. Stay, Pete. Wherever he leaves Pete, Pete just stays. And Pete also has a trick. If Pete is dropped, Pete falls. Still, Pete is not very interactive. He is much less affectionate than the neighbor's dog, and about equally as affectionate as the neighbor's cat. Now, the boy desperately wishes that Pete were as versatile as his neighbor's dog, Max. So he decides that he wants to teach Pete a new trick. The old trick, remember, is falling. The new trick will be the opposite of his old trick, to go up. The boy chucks Pete in the air, but Pete just comes right back down. But the boy considers that perhaps a training regimen might be needed, so he sets about to throw Pete in the air several times a day until Pete learns the trick. Sadly, Pete never rises to the occasion. After weeks of strenuous effort, the boy abandons his program of training. It turns out that you cannot teach an old rock new tricks. Here is Aristotle's much more sober explanation of the determinateness of natural activity. This is the first quote on the handout. He says, for example, saying that they don't come about in us naturally. For example, a stone that naturally moves downward cannot be habituated to move upward. Not even if to habituate it, you threw it upward 10,000 times. Nor will fire move downward. Nor can anything else that is naturally one way be habituated into being another way. Stones, being earthen, are naturally below. Thus, when we release them, they fall. Their stony nature inclines them to be below. Fire, by contrast, is naturally above. So when we strike a match or light the stove, the flame strains heavenwards. If you turn the match upside down, the flame will still climb upwards. The activities paired to these inclinations come along with their stony and fiery natures. They are determined to one effect. Remember the definition of nature. Nature is a source of motion and rest in that to which it belongs, primarily and per se, and not per accidens. It is nature that makes the rock when it is above go down, and it is nature that makes the rock when it is below stay. The springs of the rock's action or its very own heaviness, not an impulse bestowed from the outside, whether by force or skill. Thus, going down is natural to the stone, in the sense that it is innate or inborn into it, as it were, as odd as that is to say, and in the sense of being a change that comes about from an intrinsic inclination. By contrast, we do not have such automatic and determined direction to the outcomes characteristic of the virtues. For instance, given a bag of potato chips, I am not determined to eating the right amount rather than eating the entire bag, in the same way that a stone is inclined to fall when dropped. The realm of things that human virtues can habituate are implied to be actions or abilities that can be directed in diverse directions. Aristotle concludes, "Hence, the virtues come about in us neither by nature nor against nature. Rather, we are naturally receptive of them and are brought to completion through habit. So they are not natural in the sense of inborn. We do not come pre-equipped with them, nor do they spring into being as part of our ordinary development, the way that eyesight naturally develops in a newborn. But they're not anti-natural either. For when we speak of nature, we include some reference to the end, the telos, or goal of the thing. Virtues are naturally completive because they direct us to the goal of nature." Part 2, virtue as what makes a thing good and what makes its activity good. So let's briefly get clear on what virtue is. Virtue has as part of its notion a connection to the nature of the thing and the action by which the thing achieves its goal. I'd like to illustrate how we ascribe goodness to things because they carry out their function well, and that they carry out their function well because they have the characteristic virtue. Let's take the example of the knife. Knives are instruments for cutting. As we have seen, the nature of a thing is a certain directedness to the goal of that nature. In the case of the knife, this directedness is helpfully apparent even in the definition, which includes a reference to the function of cutting. Knives, then, are instruments for cutting, definition, and their function is cutting. Now notice that knives that are sharp are capable of cutting well, while knives that are dull aren't. The quality of sharpness makes all the difference. When we consider the sharp knife, we say, that's a good knife, because its sharpness disposes it to cut well. So notice the connection of these notions. The sharpness makes both the knife and its activity good. The sharpness is thus the excellence or virtue of the knife. Consequently, the knife is a good knife because it is virtuous, which is to say, sharp. This quotation's on your sheet now. This is the second quotation. Here's how Aristotle puts it. "Every virtue, regardless of what thing it is the virtue of, both completes the good state of that thing and makes it perform its function well. As, for example, the virtue of an eye makes both the eye and its function excellent, since it is by dint of the eye's virtue that we see well." Remember what Aristotle said about how the virtues are natural. We are naturally receptive of them, he says, and we are brought to completion through habit. To speak of the virtues as completive of the human being is to look at habits or virtues in the perspective of the orderedness of our nature to what completes it, that is, to its good. It is only by considering the knife's direction to cutting that we can understand what is good for the knife. It is for this reason that the quality of sharpness completes the knife. A sharp knife is good because it is disposed to succeed at cutting. Just as the sharpness is the completion of the knife, the virtues are the completion of the human. As natural beings, we have a distinct essence with a goal proper to it. While the habits are not our very nature, they are nevertheless modifications of our being that make us good at attaining nature's goal, just as sharpness is a modification of the knife that makes it good at achieving its goal. Part 3, powers as principles of action. The term power implies or names a principle of action. As we know, beings do many things. One writer, the great priest poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, wrote that each mortal thing deals out that being indoors each one dwells. Things to some degree do what they are. But things don't act only by means of their natures, but in addition by means of powers that give rise to specific kinds of actions. Indeed, on the Aristotelian point of view, the very natures of things are not the immediate basis of their activities, but rather things do their activities through diverse powers. We come to know powers by knowing their activities. Here are some activities: digesting, healing, seeing, running, remembering, touching, growing. Let's start with the activity of seeing. A dog sees a rabbit hopping across the grass, which catches her attention. The power of sight is activated when other beings act upon the dog's eyes by means of light, so that she receives a likeness or similitude of some body in her eye. Perhaps she will growl or bark. But after the rabbit goes out of sight, she may settle down again on the ground and close her eyes for a nap. Just a moment ago, she was seeing. Now, she is not actually seeing. We can say that she has the ability to see, because she could once again spring into the activity of seeing, if only she opened her eyes. This ability to see is clearly not the same as her very essence, for she is at all times actualized in her being a dog, but sometimes not actualized in seeing. Further, she can be a dog and not yet be capable of actually seeing, as when she is newly born, and can be a dog and no longer be able to see, if she should damage her eyes in an accident or due to disease, for instance. Not only is the power of sight distinct from her dog essence, it also seems to be seated in some physical organ, namely her eyes. That's why damaging her eyes would ruin her eyesight. This contrasts with her essence, which seems to be actual throughout her entire body, not confined to a particular organ. Also, only organs formed in the right way, the way that eyes are formed, seems to be a fit subject for the ability to see. Indeed, it would seem absurd to suggest that the power of sight could inform a nose or a block of marble. So we have named one power, sight. The power of sight is the principle of the activity of seeing. There are many other powers. The power of nutrition is that by which we digest food, which is to say, assimilate what is potentially our flesh so that it is actually our flesh. The power of movement is that by which the animal goes from place to place. The powers of the sense appetites incline us to or away from sense goods and evils. For instance, the concupiscible appetite is what gives rise to the desire for some meat that we smell cooking on the grill. The irascible appetite is what gives rise to the fear we feel when we are standing on the ledge of a tall building. I also have internal sensibilities, for instance, one by which I sense that I am sensing, and which unifies the distinct sensings of my five external senses, the so-called common sense. There are also powers for my remembering and imagining. This initial exposition should give an understanding of just how diverse the powers that we humans have. Now, on your sheet, I've provided you with a taxonomy of powers, beginning with by first broadly distinguishing vital powers, which is to say powers for activities of living things, from natural powers, here meaning powers belonging to non-living things, like stones. I take it that Thomas thinks that the powers of non-living things, like of stones to fall and of fire to burn, are examples of such natural powers. In Summa Contra Gentiles 2, Book 2, Chapter 68, Thomas Aquinas gives an interesting progressive ranking of the kinds of activities that beings have from the lowest to the highest. And he says something I think is relevant to this about our natural powers, about so-called natural powers here. He says that at the lowest level, there are certain lowest forms that are unable to engage in any operation except that to which the qualities that are the dispositions of matter extend themselves, as the hot, the cold, the wet and the dry, the rare and the dense, the heavy and the light, and others similar to these, just as the forms of the elements. He characterizes these activities, which are merely natural, as entirely material and totally immersed in matter. These kinds of activities seem to include the activities we have seen of stones and fire. In this passage, he talks about, right, the heavy and the light. So a quality by which the bodies either fall or are borne aloft. He characterizes these latter as active and passive qualities elsewhere. He also gives an example of a magnet drawing iron. So these are examples of natural powers that are directed to determinate effects. The other part of this division is the vital powers, which in certain ways are more interesting, belonging to living things, such as the vegetative powers of nutrition, growth, and reproduction. By nutrition, the living thing maintains itself in due quantity. By growth, it attains due quantity. By reproduction, it produces another instance of its kind. Then there are powers that pertain to the animal soul. They are the powers of the five senses and of the internal senses, including the common sense, memory, imagination, and estimation. There are the powers of sense appetites, including the irascible and concupiscible passions. Then there are the powers of the rational soul, including those of the intellect, the agent and possible intellect, and those of the intellectual appetite, the will. All of these are principles of activity. Thomas will argue that habits will be able to modify some, but not all, of these powers. For instance, there's not going to be any habit that modifies our digestion. In order to argue for this position, however, Thomas is going to make another division of powers according as they either act or are acted upon that will form the basis of a judgment as to what powers can have habits. And this is that second division, the division of powers according to acting and being acted upon at the bottom of the first side of that sheet. Thomas notes that there are three kinds of powers: those that only act, those that both act and are acted upon, and those that are only acted upon. With respect to those that only act, we have things like the agent intellect, which only does its activity of, you know, shining or illumining, right? And then he also gives examples of natural powers, so like the fire that is determined to burning, the stone which is determined to falling. So for instance, the natural quality of heaviness inclines the stone downwards, and it always so goes unless it is impeded by some obstacle. Then there are powers that are only acted upon. It is when the sound hits our ear or the light hits our eye that we hear or see. So the five external senses are examples of powers that are only acted upon, that are merely passive. Finally, there's something in the middle, powers that both act and are acted upon. Our possible intellect receives similitudes of things from the agent intellect, but is in turn the principle of our understanding of truths. Our sense desires are themselves moved by sense objects, but in turn move us to get or avoid those sense objects. Thomas argues that it is only those taken from this category of power that both act and are acted upon that are capable of being perfected by a habit in the proper sense. Powers that only act simply do their activity by what they are, as the agent intellect illumines or the stone falls. Powers that are only acted upon are always determined exactly to the thing that the agent does to them. But these powers that both act and are acted upon need various dispositions, or the order of various parts, to be correct in order that they attain the right goal. The fourth part, virtues as stable dispositions of powers that are directed to diverse outcomes. So according to Thomas, virtues are habits. Recall that the Aristotelian tradition names 10 most general ways of being, called the 10 categories, which are divided into substance and the 9 kinds of accidents. Substance is the most fundamental. Substance names what exists in its own right and underlies accidents. For instance, a dog, a rock, or a human. The accidents are being that exists in some substance. For instance, Fido's being 2 foot long, quantity, the brown of his fur, quality, his being the offspring of Max, relation. Quality comprises an incredibly diverse ensemble of characteristics, including aspects such as the color of the thing. Thomas holds that habits are themselves in the category of quality. A habit is a kind of quality that determines our powers with respect to their activities. For Thomas, to understand virtue, we must understand both habit and power, for virtues are habits that make our powers act in a certain way with promptness, pleasure, and ease. We saw that the term power means a principle of action. A habit is going to name a quality of a thing that is difficult to change. A quality of a thing that is difficult to change. Thomas places habits within the first species of quality, which is itself called habit and disposition. The term disposition means an order of something having parts. The term disposition can be used to refer to the category of disposition, situs, which means the way in which a thing's parts have a certain order and a place, as in the way that Socrates is in a reclining or sitting position. This is a distinct category of being, not a species of quality. But disposition can also refer to the way in which a thing has the habits that are the virtues and the sciences. Thomas's previous discussion of powers that both act and are acted upon should illumine for us what it means to say that this kind of disposition is an order of something having parts. For instance, the possible intellect is such that it receives an intelligible species from the activity of another, the agent intellect which illumines the phantasm, and in turn does the activity of understanding. The sense appetite itself is disposed to receive the sensed object from the external senses, and in turn is related to the motive powers, for instance. For these powers to be well disposed means for them to have the proper order with respect to what acts upon them, and then an order to the action that they themselves engage in. What makes these dispositions be habits in the full sense is that the disposition becomes firm and unchanging. Habits are stable dispositions of a power. Habits as stable dispositions of powers are directed to the nature and goal of the thing whose power they perfect. Thomas says that a habit primarily and per se implies a relation to the nature of the thing. Thomas lifts a definition from Aristotle, saying that in the fifth book of the Metaphysics, Aristotle says that habit expresses a disposition according to which the disposed thing is well or badly disposed. To speak of something as being well or badly disposed can only be so if we have reference to the goal of the thing. For it is only in reference to a thing's good or goal that we can ascribe goodness or badness. So we have a text here. The first part, so you have on text A under 4, under habit, Thomas says that habit primarily and per se implies a relation to the nature of the thing. And then in text B, he says, that's 49 Article 3, it is of the nature of habit that it implies a certain relation in order to the nature of the thing, according as it is appropriate or inappropriate to the nature. But the nature of the thing, which is the end of generation, is still further ordered to another end, which either is operation or something produced by operation at which one arrives through operation. In other words, habits are either directly or indirectly ordered to operation because nature, because they're always ordered, at least to nature, and nature includes in itself a reference to the operation by which a thing attains its goal. No finite being attains its perfection in its first act. All require a further actualization to be completed. For this reason, all finite beings attain their perfection only through or as the result of some operation. How then do humans attain their perfection? Since they too are not God, it is also through operation. What Aristotle recognized about human activity remains true. Unlike natural agents, the human is not simply directed by nature to just one effect, in the way in which a stone is directed to falling downwards. Rather, the human is open to or indifferent to diverse effects. Just as our powers are not determined to achieving the effects of a determinate craft, so too our powers are not determined to achieving the goals of our nature. In my actions of exchanges with other persons, I might return them something equal to what I owe them. Or I might not, for instance, by giving an insufficient amount to make an equality, and thus I would underpay my employees. When I encounter intoxicating beverages, I might desire them excessively and consequently have too many. When speaking with a friend, I might try too hard to be funny and play the buffoon. While fire may be directed to burning and stones to falling, my desire for pleasure of drink, my exchanges according to arithmetic equality, and my desire for the pleasure of conversation are not determinately directed to the human good. They are capable of being directed to diverse ends. While anyone can sometimes drink the right amount, feel appropriately in the presence of certain pleasures, say the right word, and so on, it is only the temperate person who reliably drinks the right amount, the prudent person who says the right word without erring, and so on. Here's how one contemporary writer on Thomas Aquinas puts it. This is Thomas Osborne in his book on Aquinas on the virtues. Habits are necessary because human powers are both undetermined and imperfect. Only a person who has the virtue of chastity chooses chaste acts in the way similar to that in which a heavy object falls downward. Temperance, for instance, is a stable disposition of the concupiscible passions to listen to and obey reason. Prudence is a stable disposition of the practical intellect with respect to doing. Justice is a stable disposition of the human will with respect to exchanges with others. Courage is a stable disposition of the irascible passions, fear in particular. These stable dispositions, that is, habits, are forms by which these powers, which in themselves are indeterminate with respect to many effects, are determined to the proper effect, namely, to instantiating the due order of reason in our actions and desires by properly ordering them to our happiness. In turn, I acquire these stable dispositions in a way similar to how I achieve craft knowledge, not totally the same, but somewhat analogous, by repeatedly acting in the right way. In these examples concerned with morals, just as with the examples concerned with art, I am not determinately directed to the goal of either. In each of these cases, I must become determined to that outcome, which I am initially indifferently disposed to. Thus, by repeatedly paying what I owe out of a desire for equality in my exchanges, I become just. By repeatedly restraining my desire for drink to the appropriate amount, I become sober. And by properly ordering my use of humor in conversation, I become witty. Notice also something of a difference between the sciences. So I've been talking about habits. The sciences and the crafts are going to be habits as well, but they're not going to direct us in the same way to the human good that the virtues are, because the virtues are going to direct us towards what perfects or fulfills our nature as such, whereas merely having mathematical knowledge, for instance, or merely having, for instance, the ability to play the violin are not of themselves going to direct us towards our nature. So the virtues are going to properly and fully dispose us to the goal of our nature. They're going to be natural in the fullest sense, in a way that, for instance, craft knowledge, like knowing how to play the violin, won't be. As Aristotle noted, in humans, the virtues are not inborn, nor are they natural in the sense of being the primary source of our operation. Our being is complex, and we engage in activities not directly through our essence, but through the mediation of an entire panoply of powers. However, the virtues end up being secondary sources of our activities. The virtues are habits, which are forms that perfect our powers so they reliably attain nature's goal. And habits are stable dispositions such that the agent reliably hits the mark with respect to any power that is properly habituated. Habits let us promptly, pleasurably, and easily engage in actions that would otherwise be difficult and troublesome to engage in, or that we'd have to think a lot about. So, while we cannot call virtue nature, we can follow the tradition in calling them a kind of second nature. For they do indeed make us inclined to our nature's goal, as nature makes stones inclined downwards. Not as being the primary source, but as being something that is added that perfects us and brings us to it. So in answer to the question, are virtues natural? The answer is yes and no, and in that way. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.